As the cartoon shows, many people think that pastors should be too spiritual to get angry. We have this idea that spiritual people don't get angry. Well, it's not true. The Apostle Paul, in fact, in Ephesians chapter 4, verse 26, commanded Christians to be angry and sin not. Anger by itself is not sin. God gets angry, but does not sin. Anger is an emotion. It rises up in all of us, particularly when we feel wronged or when damage comes in some way. Now, many times, of course, the emotion of anger is selfish and sinful. But not always. When we are wronged, when we are treated unjustly, the emotion of anger is righteous. In those cases, it is not the anger that is sinful, it is what we do with the anger that makes it sinful. And there is the test. When anger drives us to retaliate, to take revenge, then the anger leads to sin. David, in 1 Samuel chapter 25, where we pick up with our study this morning, gets very angry in this chapter. And he needs to learn how to deal with his anger so that he does not sin. Because essentially, God has David in his wilderness seminary right now, in his training school for leadership in these chapters. And God is preparing David to be qualified to be king, but he has to learn some lessons first. And one of the principal lessons he needs to learn is how to deal with his anger. And we too can learn from this chapter then how to deal with our anger so that we don't sin. Personal wrongs, principle number one. Personal wrongs provoke moral outrage. Let's start in verse 1. Then Samuel died, and all Israel gathered together and mourned for him and buried him at his house in Ramah. And David arose and went down to the wilderness of Paran. Samuel the prophet dies. So far as we know, David is not able to attend his funeral in Ramah, as the nation mourns for their godly prophet, their godly leader. David can't be there. Now, years earlier, of course, Samuel had anointed David as king. Now David is on the run from Saul, who is trying to kill him. He certainly can't show up in Ramah at this funeral. Samuel, his one friend, his mentor, his spiritual leader, the one he had run to first after the conflict with Saul began, he had gone straight to Samuel for guidance and wisdom. Samuel is dead. David, we can only surmise this, but I think perhaps in discouragement, travels as far away as he can get. He travels as far south as he can get. He goes to the wilderness of Paran. Now, you Bible students might remember where the wilderness of Paran is. It is way down in the Sinai Peninsula. This is the region that Moses led the Israelites in wanderings after the Exodus. That's the wilderness of Paran. It is a barren and desolate region, far from Saul's grasp, far from Israel, totally out of the promised land. Why did he go to the wilderness of Paran? Well, as a matter of fact, when you read commentators, people who write about this section, many think this is an error. They think there's an error here, that there would be no reason for David to go so far south into the wilderness of Paran, so there must have been some other reading. He must have gone somewhere else, and they try to correct it. I don't think it's an error here in the biblical record. I think it tells us something of the state of David's mind at this point. I think also that probably, as we read the rest of the chapter, David went there alone for a while. I think that David is very depressed at this point. He is discouraged. The death of Samuel left him little human hope for a resolution in this conflict. He seems to be running away from everything and everyone at this point. Do you ever feel like that? Have you ever been there? You just want to run away from it all. Life has turned sour. Nothing's gone right. That's David in the wilderness of Paran. He is ripe for the rage that will soon engulf him in this chapter. One of the conditions that sets us up for sinful anger is despair. That's when we are ripe for the rage that leads us into sin. The anger that's destructive and hurtful. When we feel like everyone has wronged us, when we've been unjustly treated, when there's no hope for things to work out, no resolution, that's when we are prone to the anger that will lead us into sin, just like David. Beware when you are in that situation. Know the warning signs. Depression is, as they tell us, really anger turned inward. And it is but a small step from that anger turned inward to the eruption that comes out and hurts those around us. Let's pick up the story then with that as the setting. Verse 2. Now, there was in Maon, there was a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel. And the man was very rich, and he had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. And it came about while he was shearing his sheep in Carmel. Now the man's name was Nabal, and his wife's name was Abigail. And the woman was intelligent and beautiful in appearance, but the man was harsh and evil in his dealings, and he was a Calebite. That David heard in the wilderness that Nabal was shearing his sheep. So David sent 10 young men. David said to the young men, "Go up to Carmel, visit Nabal, greet him in my name, and thus you shall say, 'Have a long life, peace be you, and peace be to your house, and peace be to all that you have.' And now I have heard that you have shearers. Now your shepherds have been with us. We have not insulted them, nor have they missed anything all the days they were in Carmel. Ask your young men, and they will tell you. Therefore, let my young men find favor in your eyes, for we have come on a festive day. Please give whatever you find at hand to your servants and to your son David." Now, we don't know how long David stayed away, but eventually he comes back to the region of Maon and Carmel. We don't know the time period between verse 1 and verse 2, but the scene shifts to a rich man, from the tribe of Judah, a Calebite, if you will, who owned a sheep shearing business in Carmel. The man's name was Nabal. Now, it was probably a nickname given to him because the word Nabal means fool, and what mom would name their son fool? We learn that Nabal was a harsh and evil man who treated people very wrong. He may well have been a supporter of King Saul, and his story is certainly told in a way that reminds us of Saul. There are a number of expressions in the Hebrew that people point to as pointing back to King Saul in this chapter. But the region was filled with Saul sympathizers. We already know that, because of the previous story where some of them betrayed David to Saul. Nabal had a wife named Abigail. She is his exact opposite. The author takes great pains to emphasize. She is beautiful. She is intelligent. The word intelligent didn't refer to her IQ particularly. It referred to her insight, her wisdom, her discernment. She is a wise and godly woman. She was a woman who understood people and situations, and she could act wisely in those situations, unlike her fool of a husband. But she was married to this brute this coarse and harsh man who had no sense. Now, David's men have been protecting Nabal's shepherds and sheep in the region for some time. It may be that David went to the wilderness of Paran by himself. His men stayed to protect Nabal. The region is fairly dangerous. Bandits, wild animals took their share of the herd normally, and shepherds were sometimes killed by bandits out in the wild fields and hills of this region. David and his men had protected Nabal's business interests. They had protected his shepherds for the last year. We learn that Nabal had a very successful business year, that his servants, his employees, recognized that all of that success was basically due to David's protection over this period of time. And one servant reports that David and his men, later on in this chapter, he reports that David and his men were a wall of protection for us in the wilderness. Nabal had benefited from David's protection, and he had made money off David. So David sends his men to collect for their work. Some argue that this is sort of a protection racket that David has set up in the wilderness. I think as we read the rest of the story, even Abigail seems to imply that this was an understood agreement rather than just a protection racket of some sort. It's more likely that David had kind of an agreement with the shepherds and with the people that were handling Nabal's business interests in return for something at the end, some of the profit. Now, pick up with verse 9. When David's young men came, they spoke to Nabal according to all these words in David's name. Then they waited, but Nabal answered David's servants and said, "Who is David and who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants today who are each breaking away from his master. Shall I then take my bread and my water and my meat that I have slaughtered for my shears and who give it to men whose origin I do not know?" Notice all the "my" and "I," right? This is mine. Why would I give it to anyone else? So David's young men retraced their way and went back, and they came and told him according to all these words. And David said to his men, "Each of you, gird on his sword." So each man girded on his sword, and David also girded on his sword. And about 400 men went up behind David, while 200 stayed with the baggage. So Nabal rejects the deal. He insults David, he insults his men, he treats them like dirt, he refuses to fulfill his part of the deal and take care of David, and David takes that as a personal wrong. He takes it personally. This is not fair, this is unjust. It's sort of like being fired without pay for the work you've done the entire past year. No pay, you're just done. Here's your slip, get out of here. It wasn't fair. David was angry. He's more than angry. David is outraged at this injustice. He is determined to take action to correct the wrongs done to him and his men. And we know what was in David's mind, because if you look down at verse 21, he later tells us in this chapter, "Now David had said," this is a rehearsal of what was in his mind, "Surely in vain I have guarded all that this man has in the wilderness, so that nothing was missed of all that belonged to him. I did my job, and he has returned me evil for good. May God do so to the enemies of David and more also, if by morning I leave as much as one male of any who belong to him. I'm going to kill every male in that whole area. Everyone. They're dead. I'm done with it." Now that's a rage that's pretty serious, right? And David has 400 well-armed men. He's used to fighting. David is going to get his revenge. He will kill every man in Nabal's household in this fit of vengeance. Who's David becoming like? Saul. David's becoming just like Saul. He will take out his rage in a sinful and horrible attack. on innocent people. He will use his power to destroy and murder people who have done him no wrong. Nabal did him wrong, but not those men. See, that's the horror of revenge. It's not the anger that is sin. It is what you do with that anger. Where you go with it. With that resentment, that rage that builds up in us. And the horror of revenge is that it takes over life. Now, we all feel like that at some point in our lives. That anger that is building up in us. We want to strike out. We want to hurt the one who has hurt us. Probably everyone in this room has been there at one point in your life. Children at an early age have those feelings. The mother ran into the bedroom when she heard her 7-year-old son scream. She found his 2-year-old sister with her fingers wrapped deep in his hair, pulling as hard as she could pull on his hair, and he was screaming. She gently released the little girl's grip, and she said comfortingly to the little boy, "There, there, she didn't mean it. She doesn't know that hurts." He nodded his acknowledgement, and she left the room, but she'd hardly gotten 5 steps down the hall when the little girl started screaming. Rushing back in, she asked, "What happened?" The little boy replied, "She knows now." "She knows now." "Yes. I hurt, so you're gonna hurt." That's the point of revenge, isn't it? We want someone else to feel the pain we feel. David wants to inflict pain to strike back. The problem with revenge is that in the end, revenge hurts the avenger as much or more as it hurts the one being receiving the vengeance. When our anger lashes out in uncontrolled ways like this, it recoils often upon us. Vengeance, someone has said, is a cannibal eating himself, because it comes back on us. And it happens in the little things and the big things of life. One morning, Ralph Milton woke up at 5 o'clock in the morning, and it sounded like somebody was banging on boilers up on his roof. Angry that he was awakened from a sound sleep, he ran outside in his pajamas to see what was going on, and looked up on the roof, and there was a little woodpecker, and it was pecking away on his TV antenna. Dumb little woodpecker. And it was making a horrendous noise. He was enraged that this thing had awakened him so early in the morning, so he grabbed a rock and he threw it as hard as he could at the little woodpecker, but he missed. It went over the roof, and the next thing he heard was the crash as it hit his car in the driveway. Mad that he had now smashed his car, he hauled off and he kicked a clod of dirt, forgetting that he was in his bare feet and the clod of dirt was hiding a rock. See, that's what anger does, doesn't it? We get angry and we start striking out, we start lashing out, and we're hurting ourselves in the process of the uncontrolled anger. Proverbs 29:11, "Only a fool gives full vent to his anger." So when our anger is unleashed like that, by definition, we are Nabals. We are fools. And it comes back to haunt us in life. But, second principle, listening to advice intercepts our desire for revenge. Verse 14. But one of the young men told Abigail, Nabal's wife, saying, "Behold, David sent messengers from the wilderness to greet our master, and he scorned them. Yet the men were very good to us, and we were not insulted, nor did we miss anything as long as we went about with them while we were in the fields. They were a wall to us, both by night and by day, all the time we were with them tending the sheep. Now therefore know and consider what you should do, for evil is plotted against our master and against all his household, and he is such a worthless man that no one can talk to him." That's your husband. He's such a worthless man, nobody can even talk to the guy. Then Abigail hurried and took 200 loaves of bread and 2 jugs of wine and 5 sheep already prepared and 5 measures of roasted grain and 100 clusters of raisins, 200 cakes of figs. She loaded them on donkeys. She said to her young men, "Go on before me. Behold, I am coming after you." But she did not tell her husband, Fool. And it came about as she was riding on her donkey and coming down by the hidden part of the mountain that behold, David and his men were coming down toward her. So she met them. Now David had said, "Surely in vain I have guarded all that this man has in the wilderness, so that nothing was missed of all that belonged to him. And he has returned me evil for good. May God do so to the enemies of David and more also, if by morning I leave as much as 1 male of any who belong to him." All right, thank God for a godly woman like Abigail. David's anger is out of control. His rage is driving this story to a very bad conclusion. And a servant runs to Abigail with the information. She's wise enough to discern where this is going and take quick action to intervene. She doesn't even bother to tell Nabal, since that would only make matters worse. She gathers this peace offering, if you will, of food. She rides out with her young men. She sends them ahead with the peace offering of food to pave the way for a confrontation with David. They say the way to a man's heart is through his stomach, but this gives new meaning to that expression. She meets David coming around the mountain in the wilderness. She may even have overheard the things he was saying, because the text says she was in the hidden part of the mountain as David came along. Now verse 23, "When Abigail saw David, she hurried, dismounted from her donkey, fell on her face before David, and bowed herself to the ground. And she fell at his feet and said, 'On me alone, my Lord, be the blame. And please let your maidservant speak to you and listen to the words of your maidservant. Please do not let my Lord pay attention to this worthless man, Nabal. For as his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name, and folly is with him. But I, your maidservant, did not see the young men of my Lord whom you sent. Now therefore, my Lord, as the Lord lives, and as your soul lives, since the Lord has restrained you from shedding blood and from avenging yourself by your own hand, now then let your enemies and those who seek evil against my Lord be as Nabal. And now let this gift which your maidservant has brought to my Lord be given to the young men who accompany my Lord. Please forgive the transgression of your maidservant, for the Lord will certainly make for my Lord an enduring house, because my Lord is fighting the battles of the Lord, and evil shall not be found in you all your days. And should anyone rise up to pursue you and to seek your life, then the life of my Lord shall be bound in the bundle of the living with the Lord your God, but the lives of your enemies he will sling out as from the hollow of a sling. And it shall come about when the Lord shall do for my Lord according to all the good that he has spoken concerning you, and shall appoint you ruler over Israel, that this will not cause grief or a troubled heart to my Lord, both by having shed blood without cause and by my Lord having avenged himself. When the Lord shall deal well with my Lord, then remember your maidservant." Now that's quite a speech. Abigail is as smart as she is beautiful. She appears to have had some experience in working things out for Nabal in the past. And she knows that as a woman, she will win a hearing with David. David's not going to attack a defenseless woman in the wilderness. But she also knows that she has to make the best use of her opportunity. And her speech is a brilliant argument designed to persuade David to change his plan. She begins by taking responsibility for what has happened, for the oversight. She acknowledges that her husband is a fool. But the core of her argument is actually a theological argument. She points out that God has restrained David in the past from taking vengeance and doing evil and doing wrong. I assume that she refers to the story of David and Saul that we studied in the previous chapter, where David did not take Saul's life. That story, I'm sure, was all over the nation by now. It was well known by now that David and Saul, there was basically a civil war going on, and that David had had the opportunity and refused to do it. David had spared Saul when he could have killed him. God had restrained him, she says, from taking Saul's life and thereby doing evil yourself. And she pleads with David to follow the same pattern here. Now, you need to understand the context a little bit. 1 Samuel 25 is the second of three chapters that deal with the same theme. It is the theme of anger and forgiveness. All right? There are three separate episodes. In effect, David is in God's school in the wilderness, God's school for leadership. David doesn't understand this right now, but God really has him in the wilderness because he's training him to be qualified to be king. And he doesn't want a king like Saul over the nation of Israel. And a great deal of that training has to do with David and his self-control, David and how he will deal with anger, David and how he will deal with resentment, and how he will deal with those passions that rise up in us. Can you forgive? Can you handle your anger properly? These are the things that are necessary, David, if you are going to become king of the nation of Israel. He needs to learn to trust God's justice and refrain from vengeance. Those are the leadership lessons that David is learning in the school in the wilderness. And those are the same lessons that you and I have to learn if we are going to do well in life. Verse 30. Let's pick up here. And it shall come about, she says, when the Lord shall do for my Lord according to all the good that he has spoken concerning you, and shall appoint you ruler over Israel, that this will not cause grief or a troubled heart to my Lord, both by having shed blood without cause and by my Lord having avenged himself. When the Lord shall deal well with my Lord, then remember your maidservant. There's the heart of her argument. Then David, verse 32, said to Abigail, blessed be the Lord God of Israel, who sent you this day to meet me, and blessed be your discernment, and blessed be you who have kept me this day from bloodshed and from avenging myself by my own hand. Nevertheless, as the Lord God of Israel lives, who has restrained me from harming you, unless you had come quickly to meet me, surely there would not have been left to Nabal until the morning light as much as one male. So David received from her hand what she had brought him, and he said to her, go up to your house in peace. See, I have listened to you and granted your request. Abigail knows that God has chosen David as the next king. And she knows that when he becomes king, he's going to have to deal with the people in the nation of Israel, the people who would be wronged if he took vengeance now. What he does now, she says, would come back to haunt you as king. These are Israelites from the tribe of Judah, from the tribe of Simeon. Nabal was a Calebite. That was a celebrated element of the nation of Israel, going all the way back to the famous Caleb himself. Nabal was a leading and influential businessman in the region. His servants all had families, extended families in the area. If David had murdered them all in a fit of rage, how would he be able to rule them as king? they would remember that. It would come back to haunt him when he became king. David would be guilty before God, certainly, of shedding innocent blood. He would be evil himself. He would have been sinful himself. And that guilt would haunt him in his kingdom. And the people would remember it. And it would make it very difficult for David to rule as king. And so she asked David to let God handle this. Don't make the mistake of taking vengeance yourself. Two wrongs never make a right. Miroslav Volf, a Croatian theologian, who certainly understands the cycle of vengeance. I mean, Croatia and Bosnia and Serbia, all of those nations over there, they know the cycle of vengeance, right? Miroslav Volf says this: to triumph fully, evil needs two victories, not one. The first victory happens when an evil deed is perpetrated. The second victory when evil is returned. After the first victory, evil would die if the second victory did not infuse it with new life. That's the problem with the cycle of vengeance, isn't it? Each part of that cycle simply infuses the conflict with new life. After the Civil War, Robert E. Lee visited a woman who took him to the remains of a grand old tree in the front of her home. There she cried bitterly for all of the horror of the Civil War. And she cried bitterly that its limbs and its trunk had been destroyed by Union artillery fire. She waited for Lee to condemn the North or at least sympathize with her loss. This was her pride and joy in her yard. But Lee, who knew the horrors of war and had suffered the pain of defeat, said, "Cut it down, my dear madam, and then forget it. Cut it down and forget it." In the late 1990s, Pete Pearson was appointed U.S. ambassador to Vietnam. Pearson had served 6 years as a prisoner of war in the dreaded Hanoi Hilton prison camp. When asked how he could return to the land where he'd endured years of starvation, brutality, and torture as an ambassador, he replied, "I'm not angry. I left that at the gates of the prison when I walked out in 1972. I just left it behind me and decided to move forward with my life." When you're tempted to get even with those who hurt you, remember that you can't go back. You can't stay where you are, but by God's grace, you can move forward one step at a time. Leave it. Leave it behind and move ahead. Or you will destroy your own life with the anger that imprisons you. Leave it there and move ahead. Third principle: trusting God's justice leads to enjoying God's blessing. Verse 36. Then Abigail came to Nabal, and behold, he was holding a feast in his house like the feast of a king. And Nabal's heart was merry within him, for he was very drunk. So she did not tell him anything at all until the morning light. But it came about in the morning, when the wine had gone out of Nabal, that his wife told him these things, and his heart died within him, so that he became as a stone. And about 10 days later, it happened that the Lord struck Nabal, and he died. God has His own unique ways of bringing about justice. Sometimes God's justice waits for eternity, doesn't it? But we can still trust it in eternity. Sometimes God's justice is carried out quickly. In this case, Nabal is celebrating his wealth with a party when God strikes him down. We assume that he suffered some sort of stroke or something that paralyzed him, and 10 days later, he dies. But the text tells us it was the Lord who struck him down. No one could blame David for this judgment of God's. David was innocent. Everyone saw that Nabal had received what he deserved. God's justice is always fair. It may be delayed, but it's always fair. In this case, it came quickly. And we have to trust God's justice to enjoy God's blessing in life. Verse 39. When David heard that Nabal was dead, he said, "Blessed be the Lord who has pleaded the cause of my reproach from the hand of Nabal and has kept back his servant from evil. The Lord has also returned the evil doing of Nabal on his own head." So David is thankful. "I am so thanking you, God, that I didn't do this. I left it with you, God. And you have returned justly to him what he deserved." And then David sent a proposal to Abigail to take her as his wife. When the servants of David came to Abigail at Carmel, they spoke to her, saying, "David has sent us to you to take you as his wife." And she arose, bowed with her face to the ground, and said, "Behold, your maidservant is a maid to wash the feet of my Lord's servants." Then Abigail quickly rose and rode on a donkey with her five maidens who attended her. She followed the messengers of David and became his wife. David had also taken Ahinoam of Jezreel, and they both became his wives. Now Saul had given Michal, his daughter, David's wife, to Palti, the son of Laish, who was from Galim. So David has suffered great injustice, not just from Nabal, but from Saul. I mean, Saul even gives David's wife away to another man, as if David was dead, he no longer existed. And yet God blesses David even in the wilderness with a wise wife like Abigail. God is finding ways to take care of David even in the wilderness, even as David restrains himself from taking vengeance on those who wrong him. And by the way, God takes care of Abigail too. Remember, in that culture, a woman had no way of going to work. She couldn't provide for herself in any way. Marriage was God's way of taking care of the woman in that culture. God's provision for her was marriage to David. David is learning to trust God then in this wilderness school of leadership. Forgiveness is founded on faith. If you don't believe God, if you don't trust God, you won't be able to forgive. Forgiveness is founded on faith that God will settle all accounts in His time and in His way. The problem we have with forgiveness often is that we're worried that God will forgive too, and that His grace will cover that sin. And we don't want that for the person that we're being asked to forgive. We're not going to trust God, because God, after all, is a little too good. That's Jonah, isn't it? That's the story of Jonah. And that's our struggle, too. I'm not going to forgive God, because I'm not going to forgive this person, God, because if I forgive them and I turn it over to you, I don't really trust your justice. But let me suggest to you that God is always just, because that's His character, that's His nature. So if God forgives the person that we've turned over to Him, how is God just? Because Jesus paid for their sin too. And His justice was poured out in His wrath on Christ. So if God chooses to forgive them, it's because they're placed under the blood of Christ. That's His choice, not yours and not mine. Our job is to let it go and trust God that He is just, whether it's under the blood of Christ or it's punishment for sin. He is always, always just. That is His nature. Lewis Smedes recounts a play that illustrates the power of unforgiving anger. It's the story of a German general and a French journalist. Hermann Engel is the German general, and he is sentenced to 30 years in prison after World War II by the Nuremberg court. Morio, the French journalist, is angry about that sentence by the court because Engel, the German general, had slaughtered his whole family during the war. And he didn't want him to go to prison. He wanted him to pay with his life, to die. For 30 years, Morio, the French journalist, lives for the time when he can get back at Engel. The old general survives his 30 years in prison. He emerges a tired and broken old man. He and his wife, who has waited faithfully for him all those years, build a little cabin in the woods with a desire to live out their remaining years in peace. Morio finds where they are living. He goes to a nearby town. He incites a mob from the nearby town to take vengeance upon this German general. But the French journalist was a little too much of a journalist to leave it at that. He wanted something from Engel. He wanted to know what actually happened that day when his family was slaughtered. And so the plans are set for this mob. They're going to come at night, and they're going to shoot the German and his wife, and they're going to burn the house to the ground. But the French journalist goes that afternoon to talk with the general. He wants to know what happened. But what he finds is an old man who has difficulty even remembering the events of that day. A dying man, filled with remorse for his life. And as he talks with him, he begins to feel a little for the old man. And so, he tells him that the mob is coming to kill him that night. And he offers to take the man and his wife and to lead them to safety through the woods. The German general looks at him and says, "I'll go with you on one condition. I'll go with you if you forgive me." Morio hesitates. He realizes that he can rescue the old man, but he cannot forgive him. He refuses and walks away. The old man and his wife stay. The mob comes, shoots them, and burns their house to the ground. End of story. Here's the big question. Why is it so hard to forgive? Why? Because we don't trust God's justice. We can't believe that God can settle those accounts better than we can. And so we won't forgive. Why we can't let go of the anger that engulfs us. We have become the very thing we hate whenever we carry out our vengeance instead of trusting God's justice. So here's the lesson for David and for us. We must let go of our anger, and we must let God dispense His justice. God can settle those accounts. Author Anne Lamott writes, "Forgiveness means it finally becomes unimportant that you hit back. Forgiveness does not mean that justice is never served. Forgiveness means that we leave the outcome to God. We forgive to free ourselves. If not, if we refuse to forgive, we live out our lives in the prison we have made for ourselves. Let it go. Catch a Fire is a movie that recounts a true story from South Africa. It's the real-life story of South African Patrick Chamuso, an oil refinery worker who is falsely arrested with his wife, Precious, of terrorism in South Africa. It was a false arrest. He was not guilty of terrorism. But to save his wife, Precious, he confesses to the crime. Eventually, he is let go, And he actually joins the African National Congress, an outlawed regime that seeks to end apartheid through violent measures. In essence, Patrick becomes the very thing he was falsely accused of. He becomes a terrorist. Patrick tells his story over a series of flash-forward scenes. He says, "I was sentenced to 24 years in prison on a little island at the bottom of Africa. There were nearly 1,000 of us there guilty of treason. Men spent their days breaking rocks, so many hearts filled with sorrow and anger. Our leader," and the scene shows Nelson Mandela, "told us that we could never be free until we learned to forgive. After 5 years in that prison, Precious said she was getting married again to someone else. After 5 more years, I found the power in my heart to forgive. They were later forced to end the system of apartheid that kept our people down, and we were allowed to go home." The next scene shows Patrick barbecuing while kids play soccer. He continues, "I tried to settle down and start again. I started to understand my mistakes. But that man and the pain he caused so many, that pain kept coming back. I kept seeing him, that monster." This was Colonel Nick Vos, who was the one who was so evil and tortured them and did so much evil to them. Later, Patrick is shown sneaking up behind Nick Vos, the man who hurt him so deeply. He said, "I said to myself, Patrick, you can end it now. Break his neck, kill him, end it. But as I was walking toward him, I said, no, killing him is not going to help me. Revenge is not good. Let him live, then I will be free. Let him live, then I will be free." That was Nelson Mandela's theme. You're not free until you forgive. The movie closes with a scene showing how Patrick now provides a home for displaced children in South Africa. He is free. Father, teach us to let go of the anger that destroys us and all around us. Teach us to trust your justice to settle all accounts and your grace to strengthen us to move forward and to leave behind all of the anger and the bitterness that would destroy our lives. In Jesus' name, amen. Hymn number 441 as we close this morning. Hymn number